This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome to the Wheeler Centre. What an appropriate place to be discussing philanthropy. And this discussion, Giving for the Common Good, a conversation on philanthropy with Stephen Hines. I'd like to acknowledge that we meet on the lands of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of this place known to us today as Melbourne, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. Stephen Hines, of course, is the president of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and we thank the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney and Philanthropy Australia for bringing Stephen to Australia. He's here as part of a larger project which also involves the New York-based Foundation Centre, a project to help us better understand US foundations, their role in Australia, to promote closer ties between the philanthropic communities in both countries and to demonstrate the value of transparency in philanthropy. And that's a topic we'll return to in our conversation. It's a part of that project is the launch tomorrow in Melbourne of an important study called US Foundation Funding for Australia. Stephen, welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you very much, Peter. Glad to be here.
Now, Stephen's been president of the Rockefeller Fund since 2001. Before that, and in that role, become one of the most influential figures in the not-for-profit sector in the US and internationally. He, prior to joining the fund, he was the founding president of Demos, a public policy research and advocacy organization working to enhance the vitality of American democracy. And I'm not sure if the trumped-up vitality of the current pre-selection campaign was what you had in mind, Stephen.
You can see how successful I've been.
Yeah. There we go. For much of the 1990s, Stephen was based in Prague, working on economic reform, civil society development, international security in Central and Eastern Europe as head of the East-West Institute. And prior to that, he had a significant career in government in the US. Now, Stephen, let's start with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, because it's the kind of philanthropic organisation that is sort of a bit beyond our imaginings here in Australia. How big is it and what does it do?
So thank you very much, Peter, and thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm thrilled to see all of you here, and I look forward to your questions and comments a little bit later on. So the Rockefeller Brothers Fund is a private foundation which was established by the third generation of the Rockefeller family in 1940, and today the value of our endowment is approximately $860 million U.S. dollars, and that those are funds that have been given to the foundation permanently by members of the Rockefeller family. And from the income generated from those investments, we conduct our grant making and all of our other philanthropic activities. We have three principal areas, thematic areas of interest. And the first one is strengthening the quality of democracy.
You are doing well,
aren't you? Yeah, we are. I just won't quite give up, which I suppose is something. And it is largely focused on democracy reforms in the United States, but it also has a very interesting and I think important and challenging portfolio devoted to trying to help people think about how to bring greater democracy to global governance, to global problem solving in the 21st century. And the second theme is sustainable development. And here the exclusive focus now and since 2005 is climate change and energy. And the third is peace building, and there we work largely in the wider Middle East, where unfortunately we see a great deal of conflict.
Well, the Rockefeller Fund has been in the news in Australia over the, I think it was since in 2014, when you made a decision to divest all your carbon assets, as it were, all fossil fuel investments. Was that a political decision, an ethical decision? What led to that decision?
Well, it started out as an ethical question. I mean, here we were. I mean, obviously, the irony of all of this is apparent. We are utilizing wealth that was generated in the fossil fuel industry, in the invention of the fossil fuel.
John D. Rockefeller was the founder of Standard Oil.
Exactly.
Right? That's how he made his money.
Exactly. And, you know, this was a young man who went to work at age 16 in 1855 and earned $45 in the first year of employment. And by 1900, he was the wealthiest man in the world because he was such an extraordinary visionary entrepreneur and a ruthless businessman, let's be honest. But he saw that petroleum could change the global economy, and he made it happen. So our wealth is all, you know, inherited wealth from oil. And so we found ourselves...
You're turning your back on your founder.
We are. Mm. We are. But in a way, you know, and I'll come to this in a moment perhaps, but it was an ethical dilemma for us because we are also one of the leading foundations trying to work to solve the problem of global climate change. And if you look worldwide across all of our grant making, now almost 50% each year of the grant dollars are for efforts to help prevent climate catastrophe. So I personally and members of the board and staff were increasingly becoming uncomfortable with this kind of ambiguity and the hypocritical nature of this. You know, that, as I said to the board at one point in the debate, you know, it would be as if we were funding lung cancer research on the one hand with our philanthropy and being invested in tobacco on the other. So it was a bit of a process. But the moral argument was how we started. But frankly, the moral argument only got us so far. And the ultimate thing that tipped the decision was the economic argument.
Right, because I have a passing acquaintance with a wealth fund, a wealth manager, someone who advises people on their price. It's a passing acquaintance. I don't need her services, but when people talk to her about ethical investment, she says, "Do you want to make money or do you want to feel good?" Now, is this a prudent, investment decision?
We're trying to prove that you can do both, and in fact, I would go a step further and say we're trying to prove that in this century you have to do both. And the thing that helped us get to the decision was research actually that had been conducted with the support of some of our grant making. So this was a nice connection. We supported the startup of a group in London called the Carbon Tracker Initiative, which is a think tank essentially with a staff that came out of the City of London. These were professional and successful investors who left the investment world to create a think tank to study deeply the carbon economy. And their research began to show, and they did a lot of modeling. I mean, it's very sophisticated work. If you imagine that the world is going to come anywhere close to meeting the targets that now have been set in the Paris Agreement last December, keeping global temperature rise to less than 2 degrees Celsius over the pre-industrial levels, 60 to 80% of the known fossil fuel reserves that are on the books of the fossil fuel companies, coal, oil, natural gas, have to remain in the ground unburned if we're going to stay within that cap. So that means these companies are going to be losing value over time. And as long-term investors, we're not trying to make a quick buck here. We're in this for the long term. Our goal is to maintain the foundation in perpetuity so that future generations will be able to conduct philanthropy for their times. So as a long-term investment, we began to feel quite confident that fossil fuel is going to be a loser over the long term because the world is going to have to move and is moving into a clean energy economy of the future.
So what's your response then when you come here to Australia and you've been here a little while, you spend a little time on the Great Barrier Reef, in fact, on your way to Sydney and now Melbourne, and you see announcements in the paper that the Queensland government, for example, has just approved a set of new licenses for one of the largest coal mines in the world, the Adani Carmichael mine. What's your response when you read that, when you've just told us that 80% of these resources have to stay in the ground?
So, I mean, I have to say it just strikes me as a thoroughly anachronistic decision. And I understand the reasons for it. It's a short-term business calculation. There is still a market for coal in Asia. There is still coal in the ground, and there are still miners who want jobs. So I'm really sympathetic to that dynamic. But the miners are also victims of climate change. And we need to help them move out of the business of producing more and more fossil fuels when that industry we know has to die and will die as quickly as possible, instead of propping it up in a kind of short-term calculus that doesn't make sense. It's anachronistic thinking, and it's not healthy for the planet or for the workers.
And so to bring this back to philanthropy, philanthropy has to be about more than where the grant money goes. It's got to be also about where the assets are invested. And
it does. In fact, you know, we are now and have been for several years thinking, you know, if we only focus on our grant making, that's pretty small beer, as they might say in England. I don't know whether you say that in Australia. Because even if you look at all of U.S. foundation grant making, and of course we pride ourselves on having this dynamic and large and robust philanthropic sector, but if you sum it all up, American foundations, thanks to the good data collection of my friends at the Foundation Center in New York, we know that foundations give away about $55 billion a year now.
Which is an amazing amount of money.
It's an amazing amount of money, except when you compare it to the scale of the problems. I mean, just as one comparison that is clearly not apples to apples, but it shows you how modest these resources really are. $55 billion U.S. dollars in philanthropy a year, a U.S. federal government budget of close to $4 trillion, a U.S. economy worth about $18 trillion. And yet some of this $55 billion of philanthropic dollars is actually being used around the world. So it's really de minimis. So we have to look at all of our assets. Yeah. And not only the financial ones. We have to look at our intellectual resources, our leadership assets, our brand name in the case of the Rockefellers, the convening capacity, the mobilization effort, and the ability to try to work with the other two really big sectors and to influence what they do, because they're the ones with the resources and the power.
So the private sector and government.
And government.
Yeah. And I think there are the figures for Australia are something like that philanthropic trusts and have given away about $1.7 billion since 2001. So we can see the different scale of it here. And I want to come to that in a moment, but let's just go back to the origins for a moment of the fund. Because one view, I mean, we've got similar tycoons, if you like, rich entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, setting up new versions of the Rockefeller Fund today. So yeah. Mark Zuckerberg and his wife have set up a fund. We've got the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yep.
Now, one view of this would be, well, here you have the corporations who create the problems, and then the people who get rich from it give a bit of their personal wealth so they can sleep better at night. I mean, is this too cynical a view of it all?
Well, too cynical. No, I mean, clearly there is some of that that happens in the world of philanthropy. But I think in the cases of the, I mean, and I sometimes facetiously say when I'm making a speech about climate change, you know, hi, I'm here from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. We caused global warming and now we're trying to do something about it. But there is some of that. But I think actually there's a great deal of sincerity in most of philanthropy, especially in the truly organized philanthropies. Because people are giving the money to independent institutions. They may still be involved in them, but under the laws of the United States, and I also know a little bit about the laws of Australia, with the tax advantages they get for doing that, the funds have to meet certain standards of independent governance and management, and they want to do good things with it. Now, are they trying to assuage their guilt in some ways?
Or have they spent their careers minimizing their tax obligations, for example?
Yeah, and some people do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the rules are in place, and so people make use of them. But think of the following. You know, just getting back to Rockefeller himself, who, of course, in a way was the first global tycoon. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the interesting things about his story, he went to work at the age of 16 in 1855, he made $45 that first year. We actually have his little tiny ledger book. And he gave away $5 to charity. So he was already giving away more than...
He was a Baptist.
He was a Baptist. Yeah. So he was tithing, you know, as
but,
it were.
But he also, if I'm right, and I read this in the New Yorker, he was extremely damaged when National Guardsmen opened fire on striking miners in 1914, and after that got a PR advisor to help him kind of make over his reputation, and the philanthropy grew from there. I mean,
yeah, that's basically true. In fact, it was really his son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., who his father was grooming him in the business of Standard Oil, when this miner strike, it's interesting, back to mining, a miner strike in Colorado in a mining company owned by Standard Oil, and it all went bad, and the company, the local company, sent in armed Pinkerton guards and to remove the strikers, and fires were set, and women and children died along with strikers, and it was a terrible, terrible event. And John D. Rockefeller Jr. was sent out to both kind of investigate how this could have happened and to try to, in some ways, think about how to make amends. And it had a hugely profound impact on him. And so essentially he came back to New York and said to his father, I want nothing more to do with the business. I will manage the philanthropy, but I will not be involved in the business. And that's what he did for the rest of his life.
And what's the boundary between philanthropy and advocacy, if you like? Because we hear about the, we would say Koch brothers or Koch brothers. I think you say Koch brothers.
Koch brothers, right.
So
yeah.
So they K-O-C-H. Also made their money in oil.
Right.
They're brothers who are in their 80s now, I think. And they're big philanthropists. They give to the arts. They give to hospitals. They're actually quite involved in criminal justice issues, trying to reduce the prison population and mandatory sentencing and that sort of thing. But they also have this Freedom Project, which is to the right of, well, on, let's say, the far right of the Republican Party.
Yeah, all of that is true. They're a very complex family and very complex wealth management structure and a very complex giving pattern. But there are total separations between their political giving and their philanthropic giving to nonprofit organizations. So they give money to major arts institutions. Now at Lincoln Center, one of the major theaters is the David Koch building. And they do that kind of thing in health. They do it in the arts through their foundation in a way that is completely in keeping with American philanthropic traditions. Their political giving comes out of their personal pocket. And they have a big pocket.
I can imagine that that some critics of the Rockefeller Fund might say, well, actually, your stuff about divestment, that's political advocacy. That's not philanthropy.
It may be issue advocacy, but it is not partisan political advocacy. And that's an important legal distinction and also, I think, a very important ethical distinction. Mm-hmm. We are prohibited by law from using any of our funds for partisan advantage for any individual candidate or for any political party. In fact, it is so strict that it is very difficult for us to even fund through a grant a public forum in an election year and invite all of the candidates to come and debate the issue of climate change, for example.
That would be seen as too political.
It's too political.
Okay.
But we can fund advocacy about the issue during the campaign season. So we have to be careful, but it has to be done in a way that is, A, very transparent. And this gets to this issue of transparency, which is one of the themes of our visit here to Australia and why transparency is so important. So it has to be all transparent so that everybody knows that you're not funding the political parties or the candidates.
Well, let's talk about that issue of transparency, because transparency has been an issue here in Australia with some calls for private funds to have to disclose more accounting, more about their processes, and some resistance to that from, say, a private wealthy family or individual saying, well, look, this is my money. I'm deciding what I do with it. I'm the one giving it away. Whose business is it? Anyone else's?
Yeah.
So how do you respond to that argument?
I understand the impulse completely, and I think the impulse is appropriate in a lot of cases. And again, going back to our own history, John D. Rockefeller Sr. Put up all of the money. I think it was $245 million in 1890, which at the time was a huge sum of money, to start what is now the University of Chicago. And they wanted it to be named the John D. Rockefeller University, and he wouldn't allow them to do it. And in fact, he never set foot on the campus. He did it all anonymously. And the Rockefellers, again, from their personal giving, many of them, and there are a lot of Rockefellers, it's a big family now, They also give anonymously from their personal giving. But once they began the process of institutionalizing philanthropy and getting significant tax benefits for giving the wealth away to endow these philanthropic institutions, they understood and believed in the responsibility to be transparent about it. Because we are, as a foundation, we exist. We are utilizing private wealth for public good, and the public deserves to know what we're doing with it.
And that would be your argument here in Australia as well? That
I would say when it becomes institutional and when it gets to a certain scale.
And so what needs to be, when you say transparent, what needs to be transparent? Do we need to know where the money's going, where the assets are invested, and also the selection procedure, how the decisions are made as to which, you know, if people are making applications for grants, who wins and who doesn't?
Well, I think it's a bit of a journey. I don't think you go from, you know, 0 to 60 in 2 minutes. So I think the key thing in the beginning is to say, where is the money going? You know, who is benefiting from this tax-advantaged funding? And that's the key place to start with the transparency. But I do think there are real advantages to moving further along on that journey. And so in our case, and this is not something that has been true throughout our 75-year history, some of it has only been true in the last few years. And in fact, I can share with you a decision we made last week about another step in transparency. So in our case, if you look at the website of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, www.rbf.org, you will be able to find information about just about everything. The process of how we make the decisions. We have a searchable database of all of our grants, so you can type in Australia and see what we're doing in Australia. You can type in global warming and see what we're doing on global warming. You can see our committee structures of the board and what their charters are. You will see our investment policy and our asset allocations. I mean, you will find basically the whole story. And as I said in a conversation earlier, the one thing that I haven't succeeded, and I probably was wrong, I went to the board about a year ago and I said, you know, we're really, I think, on the forefront of really being a fully accountable and transparent institution. We have such good board meetings and good discussions, and we take such good minutes. Why not put the minutes on the website? And that one they didn't want to do. So, you know, that's fine. And that's why I say it is a journey. You know, you push as far as you can. But I think the concept of where's the money coming from and where is it going and what's the benefit, what's the impact, these are the things that are really critical.
Okay. And how do you measure impact? I mean, how do you know what the impact is? How do you assess that?
That is a very, very difficult part of the business. And I think we have to work at it, and we have to be very honest about what we can say about impact and what we don't know. Because, again, we are small players. So we're a foundation that, among other things, is focused on climate change. Climate change is a huge global issue. There are many actors, governmental, intergovernmental, philanthropic, private sector, and a lot of players who are contributing different resources and capabilities to trying to help solve this problem.
Or not.
Or not. The others who are doing other things.
Yeah, right. Stick in the spokes. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you have to be very careful about attribution. How much can you really claim our work contributed to this versus others? And what's the causality? We made grant X. How do we know that it really accomplished Y? So, and in a lot of philanthropic work, unlike business, it's not really measurable. You can't have a set of quantitative metrics that are going to really convince you that you're doing well. It's not just a simple bottom line kind of calculation. But that doesn't take us off the hook. You know, it says the responsibility is to collect evidence, collect qualitative evidence, and do the best you can by asking the question, how do we know if we're contributing to progress against goals that we've set? And sometimes, on a periodic basis, that means commissioning outside researchers to come in and examine your work, go out and talk to the grantees, get out in the field, talk to people who weren't successful in securing grants from you, and come back with an assessment that's independent, which we do on a regular basis, and then publish those assessments on the website as
more
another statement of transparency. So, you know, I always like to remind people on this impact question to keep in mind the wonderful caution of Albert Einstein, who said not everything important can be measured and not everything that can be measured is important. But that doesn't mean we are off the hook. We have to constantly be striving to at least cut some sense of whether we're having an impact.
Well, the other question about impact is, as you made the point earlier, that you know, the U.S. federal budget is $4 trillion and your whole sector is giving out $55 billion in funds. So how do you decide where to put the money? I mean, you know, there are an endless number of causes and problems to solve. How do you then make sure that you've got some sort of focus so that you can have an impact?
Yeah, well, the focus is really the big challenge. So, because you can't, you know, I think we're probably trying to do many things as it is, but it's a strategy process. And in the case of our foundation and most, you know, well-established and larger foundations, the board sets those strategies with the active recommendation of the staff. So it's incumbent on us to come to the board with a strategy proposal, and then the board debates it and challenges it, and they listen to outside experts, and ultimately the board sets the overall framework, and then within each of the program areas, we then set very specific strategies. So, and that's, you know, when I was hired to be president in 2001, we spent 2 years on that process, because the board had, part of the reason they were hiring a new president was that they wanted to have a fresh look. And one of the things we concluded pretty quickly in that process is that we were trying to do too many things. We had too many intellectual areas of interest, and we were working in too many places around the world with too little money to really have significant impact. So it was exactly to your point. So we ended up narrowing the field down from 8 subject matter themes to 3 and thinking very differently about geography. And I still worry that we're trying to do too much, but we are much more focused and I think much more strategic, and we're taking the long view. So we don't change the strategy very frequently, because many of these problems do not respond to short-term solutions. So you have to think carefully about what you're going to get into and then stick with it long enough to really make a contribution over time.
And when you talk about strategic philanthropy, then I guess on the one hand you're distinguishing it from kind of charity, which would be, you know, housing, I suppose, immediate relief type work. That's not what you're in. That's right. Not what you see as philanthropy, is it?
No, and we make this distinction between traditional charity and strategic philanthropy only as a way of illuminating the choices. Both are completely valid. And both are needed, and many foundations, our own included, will do some of both. We tilt toward more efforts to look long term at root causes of problems, the notion of strategic philanthropy. But we, you know, when there are natural disasters, we too will provide funds for relief. And both of those are noble uses of private wealth. So it's not a pejorative to try to make this distinction. It's just a way of organizing your thinking about it. But I do think that given the challenges we face in our world in this century, we as a global civilization have to be very strategic. Otherwise, we are going to face some terrible, terrible dislocations in this century.
So you're thinking of climate change.
I'm thinking of climate change, but I'm also thinking about the whole economic structure, the whole way capitalism has evolved since the invention of the steam engine. I'm thinking about democracy and the challenges we're seeing in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. Democracy, there's a kind of a paradox, because the 20th century, with the collapse of communism and the demise of the Soviet Union, created more nominally democratic societies and more democratic citizens than any time in human history, and yet we see the decline of the quality of democracy, and the reemergence of a kind of neo-authoritarian style of democracy in many places around the world that is very, very worrying. And so I think we've got to think about how to reinvent democracy for the 21st century and reinvent global decision-making, because so many of these problems now no longer can really be solved by one nation state acting within its own borders.
Yeah, we might throw the refugee issue.
Absolutely. Terrorism, refugees, climate change, pandemic health challenges, on and on and on.
So is strategic philanthropy also thinking about how the small, relatively small amount of philanthropic funding might seed something else or might leverage other funds? Or
yes.
Is that another aspect of
it
being
is.
Strategic?
I think
work?
It is. So leveraging is really a key word here. So, and that's, I think of that in multiple dimensions. One dimension is trying to use all of your assets, financial and otherwise, because you're leveraging more capacity at that point. A second way to think about leveraging is to work in collaboration with other donors. And this is why transparency is also extremely helpful. It's, if I'm interested in climate change and I'm looking for partners, I need to know who they are. So having data that's publicly available about who's funding in climate change gives me an opportunity to build collaborative relationships. And it's also about leveraging the big sectors, as we talked about a moment ago. You know, one simple analogy to think about philanthropy is that you have these two really large ships, the private sector and the public sector, and philanthropy has these small tugboats, you know, and can we push them,
nudge them.
To go into the right safe harbors? And that's a very high leverage. When you get public policy change or corporate behavior change, that is a very high leverage use of philanthropy.
We've remarked already on the difference in the scale of philanthropy between the US and Australia. It seems to be in the US that philanthropy is much more deeply embedded in the culture, including the culture of business, than it is here in Australia. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think that it's, I think it is partly due to the, and there's an interesting paradox here. It's partly due to the kind of egalitarian roots of American democracy, the notion that the American nation was born of the notion that all men are created equal, even though we know, of course, that they weren't being treated equally and still aren't in many cases. And the notion of the American myth of the American dream, which for a long period of our history wasn't a myth, but increasingly for many Americans is not a dream. And is more of a nightmare. But this is in our national narrative. It's in our belief about ourselves as a nation and a people. And so philanthropy is in many ways an extension of that. It's a way of expressing our communalism in a society that also emphasizes individualism. And so it's part of the balance that I think is inherent in how the country was born and in the framing documents and in the framing philosophy.
But it's interesting because Australia will also claim to have an egalitarian tradition or myth, however you want to see it. But here it would be more expressed in terms of a view that government should play a leveling role through a progressive taxation system, through public goods, education, health, universal health care, things like that.
Personally, I kind of like that model, but...
do you think these two things, though, are in conflict? And that the idea that you need small government to have big philanthropy, and if you've got larger government, I wouldn't call Australia big government, if you've got larger government and a greater welfare state, then you're not going to get the philanthropy? Because we'll say, well, look, what do I pay my taxes for?
Yeah.
Why should I give more money? We have this universal healthcare system.
Yeah, there is a bit of a tension in that, but there is a tension in what we might call democratic capitalism, which is the mixed economy system in which many countries around the world, most countries around the world, are now operating. And the, you know, the fact is that we have huge value for free market behavior because it is powerful, it is creative, it is generated enormous progress, a lot of wealth, reduced a lot of poverty. It has just, but left on its own, it also leaves a lot of dislocation. And there are a lot of market failures where private sector activity simply doesn't go, won't address. And where private sector success is dependent on the state, security, education, other things.
I think Obama, President Obama said, you didn't build that.
Exactly.
At some point when he was talking about the amount of the wealth of successful businesses is built on the infrastructure that the state provides.
Exactly. I mean, if you deconstruct an iPhone, the components that you find in there that Steve Jobs and his brilliant creative team assembled in a small package and made work well, a lot of them were the result of federally funded research projects. So, you know, this notion that government is bad is just not true. There is ineffective government and there is more effective government, but we need both. And you know, in my own view, looking at the U.S., the periods of our country's greatest success have been when there has been a really creative balance between the market and democratic governance. And at the moment, I'm afraid what we've had is hyper-capitalism and impaired democracy. And that has led to, just growing levels of economic inequality, growing levels of poverty, and a kind of a stuck middle class, which used to be the guarantor of our democracy and the engine of our economy, and now has been suffering with stagnant family incomes, in fact, declining family incomes.
And it's shrinking as incomes are polarizing between low and high.
Exactly. Yeah.
So in that environment where we have, some people call it the winner-take-all economy, where you have someone like Facebook, right? There is the second best is way back in the back stalls. I mean, who remembers MySpace?
Right.
Like you have a digital good. It wins the whole market. So this is increases polarization, increases inequality. So then you need to get the winners to be more philanthropic or to pay their tax or both.
Both.
So here in Australia, we've had lots of winners from the mining boom and other things. How do you go about convincing the wealthy to be philanthropists? I mean, do you shame them into it? Do you offer them bigger tax breaks? What do you do to get, what would we need to do in Australia to get more philanthropists, do you think?
Well, I think, again, I would bring this back to the theme of transparency. I think the more that people see what philanthropy can do, the more others may become interested in philanthropy. You know, people, I really do believe that there's a lot of human goodness in everyone. And people who are wealthy want to do good things. And they care about their children and they care about their countries. And they want to know that they can do good things. And so if they see others that are having real impact with private wealth through philanthropy, it's inspiring. I mean, look at the Giving Pledge as one example, where Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and David Rockefeller joined them early on. David is the now at age 101, the one remaining Rockefeller brother and a remarkable man. And now there is this collection, I don't know what the number is up to, of very wealthy global philanthropists who pledged to give away at least half of their assets in philanthropic purpose. And it, you know, they inspire each other. And so we need more of that, but we also need, frankly, we need the wealthy leaders to stand up and say, we need government, and we need government to work well, and we need taxation. And we need to have fair taxation, and we need enough taxation to fund the things that society needs that the private sector is not providing, including infrastructure, which is absolutely essential for the efficient functioning of a market. And in our own country, infrastructure is on a huge decline. Vice President Biden landing at LaGuardia Airport in New York said it's like landing in a third world country. It didn't go over well with my fellow New Yorkers, but they also were kind of sympathetic because it is a kind of shabby airport.
So a fund like the Rockefeller Fund aims to be there in perpetuity. So
right.
You don't spend your capital, you spend the interest. The pledge, the giving pledge that you mentioned, The idea is to spend your money before you go, not leave it all for the kids or whatever.
Well, but part of that can be leaving it in a foundation, right? So, I mean, that's what John D. Rockefeller did. He gave away, I think the number is, in total, he gave away around 90% of all of his wealth in his lifetime. But he gave it to foundations that are working in perpetuity.
And how important is it that philanthropy is bold, if you like, that it does things that it ventures into areas that are unpopular?
Well, I think this is a really important opportunity for philanthropy. Again, given how small we are, it's another form of leveraging. We have the ability, because of our independence, because of our resources of various kinds, to take risks that others won't, that are politically unacceptable to government and economically unacceptable to business. So these are things that the other two sectors are not going to try. We can experiment. We can test out new models, new concepts. We can fail. And in fact, I would say if we're not failing some of the time, we're really not doing our jobs. Because it is with that early kind of investment in new ideas and new concepts that we can really trigger big change. And that's the other high leverage aspiration of philanthropy.
Is it just new ideas and new concepts, or is it also areas where others fear to tread?
It's some of that too, sure.
So I'm thinking something like working with people released from prisons. It's
sure.
not a politically popular, they're not a group that people have a great deal of sympathy for, but that seems to me the sort of area where...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kinds of things. Things that are controversial, where actually taking leadership and helping to educate as part of that is a very valuable contribution. And we have to manage our risk prudently, because if all you're doing is high risk work, you have the risk of losing both resources and capacity and credibility. But we need to take this risk, because we're in a period that really demands massive and continuous innovation, and in all sectors, and philanthropy can be a source of innovation, and we need to be.
Okay. Well, I think we might be ready to take some questions. We'll have a couple of microphones coming down the sides. And so think about your questions and put your hands up. The lights will come up in just a second. How important is that other aspect of maintaining reputation? And how difficult is that? So, for example, with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in divesting from fossil fuel, I can imagine there would have been some of your supporters who would have been very uncomfortable with that decision.
There were, and frankly, it took us, you know, most of a year of debate internally to get all of our stakeholders aligned around that decision, because it was a big decision in many, many ways. But
so there was a lot of resistance at board level?
Yeah, there was in the beginning. There was some real pushback at the board level and on our investment committee and from our investment advisors. People asking us the same question you asked me about, do you want to make money or do you want to do good? But having really looked at it carefully together in a really open and iterative and in a way data-driven discussion, came to the conclusion that we did. But one of the things that was appealing about it in the end for the Board of Trustees, half of whom are members of the Rockefeller family, was the fact that they were utilizing one of their assets in a very dynamic and creative and powerful way, and that was the name Rockefeller. Because the irony of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund divesting from the source of the wealth that generated it, of course, became a big story around the world. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was the story that had more value than the financial withdrawal of our funds from the fossil fuel marketplace. That was pretty de minimis, but the symbol of it and the use of the leadership and the brand was very powerful.
And has it fully transitioned now?
No. As we said at the time, we were going to get out of coal and tar sands oil pretty much immediately by the end of 2014, which we have done. And now we're down. So with gas and oil, we're down from what was at the beginning of 2014 around 7% of our funds, down now to about around 3.5%.
Okay. So it's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
Has it worked out economically?
So far, pretty well. We have a standard benchmark against which we measure our investment performance, and then we also created a fossil fuel benchmark.
And as a comparator.
So. Yeah, and so far we've been outperforming both benchmarks, but it's early days. So.
Okay, it's time for your questions. We've already got some hands up. Someone will come to you with a microphone, and then they'll let me know who's got the microphone. And okay, over there. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Lifman, Swinburne University. You've spoken very persuasively about a very established approach to philanthropy grant making, but as you would obviously know, the field is now becoming increasingly diverse, and there are new models in social entrepreneurship and impact investing and all sorts of new hybrid forms of philanthropy. And I wonder what contribution you think they're making to the landscape and what their future is.
Thank you very much. I am a big advocate of diversity in philanthropy, and I use that term in its full meaning, both in terms of the organizations we run having diverse boards and staffs, but also diverse forms of philanthropy and diverse styles of philanthropy and diverse approaches in philanthropy. So I think some of the new experiments in venture philanthropy are very exciting.
Maybe give us an example of what Michael's talking about there, the sorts of ideas, social impact investing, those sorts of things. Is Rockefeller doing this, or are you still more in the traditional grant?
Well, we're more in the traditional grant. The one thing we are doing is impact investing. But in our case, the way we are defining and actualizing impact investing is from our portfolio. So we are also not only divesting from fossil fuels, we are actively seeking business investments in clean energy technology, in energy efficiency, in other business solutions to climate change that we are convinced can produce the same level of market returns, investment returns, as the other investments that we make. So, and we now have 10% of our assets are invested in exactly those kinds of mission-driven impact investments. But these new forms of venture philanthropy, which include, for example, hybrid kinds of institutions, so investments in social entrepreneurship where there is a for-profit dimension and a nonprofit or philanthropic dimension, and the two are blended in ways that create dynamism, I think is very interesting to watch. I would say, and I suppose it's not surprising, representing one of the quote-unquote old philanthropies, that I do think we have to be careful in all of this to really flesh out what's rhetorical and what's really different. Because a lot of the new philanthropy is making grants and trying things that the old philanthropies are doing as well. But there is some innovation, and I think that's all to the good.
Okay, next question. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for what you've said tonight. What I was wondering, is there room for the Rockefeller Foundation to actually initiate with governments about the decisions they make and about giving permission for mining? And for instance, with the Queensland government, is it feasible that you would go home, talk to your board, and say what you've seen about the bleaching and all that sort of stuff, and then the Rockefeller Foundation come back to the Queensland government and say, we can give you a grant for you to turn this around, to investigate with the mining corporation.
Make the question. I think you've made the point.
Yeah. To actually come up with a different plan for renewable energy.
Well, using that as a hypothetical case, because I don't want to mislead anybody this evening to think that we're going to come back immediately with some substantial grants, because the process is just a little more complicated than that. But hypothetically, the answer to the question is yes. And we are involved in exactly those kinds of activities elsewhere around the world, including in the U.S., and also in China. So we have a major set of activities in China that are through grant making, but are working very closely with the government in Beijing on its approach to reducing its dependence on coal and its dependence on other fossil fuels. So the theoretical answer is absolutely yes.
Okay, now next question.
Hi, Stephen. I'm Andrea Rennett. I'm from Kids Thrive, and we're a Melbourne arts organisation that works with 9 to 12-year-olds, collaborating with them around the ideas of becoming philanthropists at 9 to 12.
Great.
And the whole purpose, the whole thing of it is that they have to focus on resourcefulness above resources.
Mm-hmm.
So and relationship-centred philanthropy. So my question to you, as clearly a deep and creative thinker, is if tonight someone got into the Rockefeller piggy bank and took every cent you had, what would you say are the essential practices and attitudes of a deep philanthropist?
So I would say I would start with the attitudes and the values. So I think, and this is where charity and strategic philanthropy start from the same place. It's about compassion and caring and humility and sincerity. And start with that. Second, start from what really inspires you. So if you're inspired to help children with autism, start there. If you're inspired to work on trying to stop the bleaching of the extraordinary Great Barrier Reef, start there. Start with things that inspire your passion and bring to that passion those values of creativity and caring and concern, and then organize as the third step. So in the organizing is get some additional expertise, draw on some people who really know the subject matter, structure a strategy, think deeply about it, read, learn, see what others are doing, find partners, and get it organized, and then begin to apply the resources with a kind of a thoughtful and careful decision-making process, and stick with it for a bit, and ask yourself, how do I know if we're making progress? So those are the steps that I would encourage people, but it's got to start from values and attitudes of creativity and compassion and sincerity, and we can be bold and humble at the same time.
Hi, I'm Peter Singer from Princeton University and the University of Melbourne. I wanted to push you a little bit more on impact, because you did talk about the importance of impact, but you didn't really give us any examples of what you've done where you think something has paid off really well. Or for that matter, examples where you've done an evaluation study and things haven't paid off. And I wanted also to ask in terms of your choice of areas, because you mentioned three areas. One that you haven't really talked about is the global peace, and particularly you mentioned the Middle East. I mean, what would it take for you to think that maybe this area is just too hard, that you're not actually doing any good in this area, that there are bigger global forces that you can't seriously influence, and just say, we ought to get out of that, and we ought to do something where we know we are having a positive impact. I mean, I agree that you can't measure everything, but it is good when you can measure things and you can know that you are actually doing some good, as compared to other cases where you might just have to throw up your hands and say, we really don't know if we're making any progress here.
Sure. Well, that's a great, great set of questions. And that's the kind of discussion we have pretty much on a daily basis. So, and I'll try to kind of quickly answer different parts of that multi-segmented question. So first, a couple of examples. So in the environmental area, one of the earlier engagements before we moved exclusively on climate and energy was on forestry management. And in a collaboration that we helped to forge with other foundations in the Pacific Northwest, in the U.S. and Canada, over a more than a 10-year period, collectively investing millions of dollars in a process to help save what is 25% of the world's remaining pristine coastal temperate rainforest and create new livelihoods for the communities that were dependent on logging, and use it as a model to create a global forest certification mechanism so that consumers and builders are buying wood that has been raised and harvested in a certified sustainable fashion. So it had local impact and it had global policy change and business change impact. But it was more than 10 years. It was a collective effort with multi-millions of dollars. And we commissioned an outside examination of this who documented the impact that I've just described in very shorthand terms. So that's one example. In the peace-building side of things, this is a question we really are deeply asking ourselves at present, because the problems seem so intractable. But even though they do seem intractable, what we do know is that the formal mechanisms of peace building don't seem to be getting us very far either. And our theory of change here is that we need to bring the bottom up into the process of building peace. So we need to bring the voices in the conflict zones more into the process of trying to solve the conflict, negotiate the settlements, bring peace. Because when it's done at the multilateral level or the state-to-state level, those voices are getting lost and peace just isn't durable. And we've seen this in other examples around the world. So I'll give you an example of a real impact in the peace-building area. In 2002, we decided that we were going to explore the possibility of using philanthropic resources to create a dialogue unofficially between senior Americans and senior Iranians about the issues that divided our two countries. It was extremely complex work. We managed to get it going over a year's time, and we supported an unofficial track to diplomatic effort with my friend Bates Gill, who is now at the University of Sydney and then was at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute as our host. And we brought together these teams totally off the record. This was totally non-transparent philanthropy, except that the grant making was there. It just didn't reveal names and it didn't reveal a lot of the details. And over a 14-year period, that process generated insights and ideas that were communicated directly to the Bush administration in the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon, and directly to the Supreme Leader and the other leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then into the Obama administration, and contributed significantly to the ability of the two sides to come together in the context of the P5 plus one negotiations and achieve a nuclear settlement. So to me, that was a pretty good case of impact. Didn't cost us a whole lot of money. It was a high risk, kind of bold venture. It was really hard work. It was also one of the most exciting and enlightening experiences I've ever had. And I think it really contributed along the way here.
The third part of Peter Singer's question was, is there a time where you say, look, we can't make any impact here. Let's save our money and do something else.
So we are, as I said, we're really kind of debating that question right now with regard to Israel and Palestine. We are involved in Israel and Palestine, and we are supporting Israeli groups and Palestinian groups and some American groups to try to change the political will, to try to create political will for peace. And our board had another debate about this at our board meeting in March, just a few weeks ago.
We're getting a bit of transparency those minutes they didn't want public.
Yeah, exactly. But they were asking exactly this question, you know, are we wasting our money in this conflict? Couldn't we use those funds in other areas where we can be more confident of having positive impact? And thus far, they have decided to stick with us on this, in part, interestingly enough, because of the Iran example. When I first proposed that we get involved in Iran in 2002, some members of the board were kind of scratching their heads. They thought this was a slightly crazy idea, but all right, it was a small amount of money, you know, give it a shot. And there was a long period of time, including a period when the Iranian president was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was, just a terrible leader. And the board would say, well, maybe this is the time to give up. But we convinced them to stick with it, and the long-term payoff was there. So at the moment, the board is asking us that question. Should we stay involved in Israel-Palestine? It's controversial. You know, there doesn't seem to be any progress. And our answer is, let's give it some more time. Let's nurture this change in political will, because that's the only way peace is ever really going to happen. And so far, the answer is we're going to stick with it.
Okay. Now, I'm sorry we don't have any time for further questions. I'd like to thank the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney and Philanthropy Australia for bringing Stephen Hines to
As would I. They have been wonderful hosts.
And thank you, of course, to the Wheel Centre, to you, our audience, for coming out tonight. And above all, thank you, Stephen Hines.
Peter, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.